Mr. Bumble in Charles Dickens' Oliver Twist gives it as his opinion that the law is an ass. Would that were the worst of it. Unfortunately, history provides us with abundant evidence of the fact that the law has on occasions been a ferocious dragon that eats harmless asses for breakfast. Hundreds of thousands of men and women, innocent men and women, have over the centuries been dispossessed of their property, incarcerated in jails, even executed, sometimes by means of barbaric cruelty. And all this not in breach of legality, but by sentence of the courts, and in the name of law and order. Why does it happen? Well, you could argue it happens because governments, in their careless folly, enact bad laws. That's certainly true. You could argue that it happens because courts, in their blinkered pedantry, enforce bad laws. That's also true. But I want to suggest to you this morning that it happens supremely because men, in their proud autonomy, think they have the right to make laws in the first place. When the fact is that true law is never made, but rather found. The cogency of true law rests not on the arbitrary dictates of any human legislature or judiciary, but on the eternal and unchanging character of God, our Creator. Down through the centuries, you can trace two quite distinct strands of political thought which divide from one another over precisely this fundamental issue of jurisprudence. On the one hand, there are advocates of what's technically called positive law. They see law as a branch of science. On the other hand, there are advocates of what's called natural law. They see law as a branch of ethics. An important theorist in the former camp of positive law is John Austin. In his book, The Province of Jurisprudence Determined, published in 1954, he seeks to free law, quote, from the metaphysical mists with which it has been covered by speculations on natural justice. His view, law has nothing whatsoever to do with ethics. Law is a structure of pure logic, a system of statutes resting on the absolute legislative authority of the state. And it is the sole business of a judge to determine what the law is. He's to do this with scientific rigor and without regard to any subjective moralizing considerations. Because, in John Austin's view, the vital thing about law is that it should be certain, invulnerable to prejudice or circumstance. The law of the land must be predictable, he says, just as predictable as the law of gravity and just as inexorable. That's positive law. An advocate of the other side, what's technically called natural law, would be Lord Alfred Denning. When he was master of the rolls in this country, he repeatedly protested his dissatisfaction with the growth of positive law and with the erosion of equity as a principle of English jurisprudence. He points out in many of his books that the courts of chancery in this country traditionally possessed jurisdiction to mitigate the harshness and rigidity of the strict letter of the law as decided by other courts. It was, in fact, the constitutional duty of the Lord Chancellor to see that equity, that is, fairness, prevailed in this country, even at the risk of a certain amount of logical inconsistency and unpredictability in the law. But recent changes in the structure of the judiciary have effectively done away with that role. There is now only one system of courts in this country, one system of law, and that is the statutory law of Parliament. As a result, the courts now have very little elbow room to redress grievances that arise from intrinsic inequities in the law. And many jurists are beginning to note the dangers of this. Denning was indefatigable in his objections to it, and many of his controversial legal decisions come close to being a judicial protest against it. Sometimes one feels he has flown in the face of statutory law quite deliberately in order to make a point. Because for him, the business of a judge is not only to determine what the law is, but what the law ought to be. For him, the state is not at liberty to make laws as it pleases, Law can only constrain the obedience of free men, he argues, when it conforms to the higher law, the law of nature, which for Denning is quite definitely the law of the Creator. While certainty is important, there's a higher priority for any legal system, namely justice. And as a result, a judge can't be content simply to listen to the voice of scientific logic. He must heed also the voice of moral conscience. Now, I have to confess, I'm entirely on the side of Lord Denning in this particular matter. Because Mr. Bumble is right, you see. The law is sometimes an ass. And when it is, it's the duty of the judge to say it's an ass. And to overrule its asinine stupidity. And when the law is so positive, so watertight, so immutable, that it won't allow a judge to do that, that's when the dim-witted ass is in danger of turning into a fire-breathing dragon. I say again, our problem is not just that governments enact bad laws. They're fallible, they're bound to do that sometimes. Not just that courts enforce bad laws. They're fallible. They're bound to do that sometimes. The root of legislative malpractice, the root of miscarriages of justice on the grand scale in this world has always been that man thinks he has the right to make and enforce laws without reference to the authority of God and the universal moral law of which he is both author and judge. Now, our Bible story this morning graphically illustrates this very point for me. It tells how an innocent man was condemned to death by a blatantly discriminatory statute, but a statute which could not be abrogated in the courts for the simple reason that the courts were committed to the immutable certainty of positive law. Follow with me then the story. The story of the day they made prayer illegal. You see, in the empire of the Medes and Persians, as I appear increasingly in the courts of the United Kingdom, law was made by the government. And little attention, indeed no attention, was paid to the demands of natural justice in balancing that positive law of the kingdom. Daniel stands for us, it seems to me, as an example which all believing men need to emulate of how to live a life of testimony to the higher law when you're confronted by such a world, such a system. Follow the story then. First, in verses 1 to 9, we look how the law was passed. Then at verse 10, we'll see how Daniel broke the law. Then finally, in the closing verses from verse 11 onwards, we'll see how God overruled the law by his own authority. First, the law the government passed. It pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom, with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. The satraps were made accountable to them so the king might not suffer loss. Scholars argue a good deal about just who this particular Darius was. If you were here last week, you'll probably remember that we said then that the city of Babylon, in which this book of Daniel is set, was conquered by Cyrus and integrated into his new empire of the Medes and Persians. The only Darius that archaeologists can find reference to around this time came to the throne of the Medo-Persian Empire some 8 years after Cyrus's death. So skeptical commentators predictably conclude that the narrator of Daniel has once again got his history muddled and confused these two emperors. Even if you don't believe in the infallibility of the Bible, I find that quite hard to accept. Because all the history books of the Old Testament are perfectly aware of Cyrus and attribute the fall of Babylon to him and distinguish him quite clearly from his later successor, Darius. The book of Ezra, for instance, mentions both of these emperors in the correct order. So even if the author of Daniel was written as some scholars suggest, many years after the events, so he had no personal knowledge of them, It's most unlikely he could have made such an elementary mistake. It was there, in his own Bible, in his own books of Jewish history. And it's not, after all, as if he didn't know about Cyrus, because he mentions him by name at the very end of this chapter, for one thing, in 6 verse 28. So it seems to me there are really only two possibilities that are worthy of consideration. The first, held by some scholars, is that Darius and Cyrus were one and the same man. It's not impossible, because kings often had several names in the ancient world. And those who take this line argue that chapter 6, verse 28 ought to be rendered as in our NIV margin, for those of you who have it. Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius, that is the reign of Cyrus, the Persian. It's a perfectly legitimate interpretation of the Aramaic conjunction there. Alternatively, in my view preferably, you have to take the view that this Darius must be some senior figure in the government of Cyrus who was given jurisdiction following the conquest over the conquered province of Babylon. Supporters of this line point out that the author of Daniel does seem to deliberately distinguish Darius from Cyrus on the grounds of their ethnic origin. He talks about Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Persian. What's more, if you look at chapter 9, verse 1, Daniel himself says that Darius was made ruler over the Babylonian kingdom, a phrase that might suggest that he was not emperor himself, but appointed to office. The fact that archaeology hasn't so far turned up any references to any such regent ought not to be given too much weight. After all, King Belshazzar, that we were looking at last week, was regarded as a completely fictional character by liberal scholars for many years, until his name was discovered in some ancient Babylonian documents. The same may well turn out to be true of King Darius. But whoever Darius was, for the purposes of the story, it's simply enough to note that he had plenipotentiary power in Babylon, where Daniel was. Power to organize the province as he wished. And he was quick to spot the asset that he had in Daniel in this respect. A man who by this time must have been getting on for 80 years of age, but who clearly had lost none of his administrative skills. Verse 3, Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. For the readers of this book originally, the Jewish readers of this book, Daniel's record of success in the service of the Persian Empire must have been very relevant. As we've mentioned on many occasions in this series, the Jews were exiles at this time. And they had to decide to what extent it was right for them to get involved in the pagan society that surrounded them. Would it compromise their faith to identify with or cooperate with the Persian imperial authorities? Or indeed in later days with the imperial authorities of Greece and Rome? Well, the answer of the book of Daniel is no. No compromise is involved, provided you are careful to retain the moral standards which God requires. And that's a lesson which is of importance to Christians, too. I still encounter quite regularly in this city undergraduates, for instance, who think that he or she can only serve God really acceptably if they become a pastor or a missionary. Anything less than full-time service has to be a sort of spiritual second best. Well, that's nonsense. Remember Daniel. His office in Babylon was God's calling to him, though he was also a prophet. So your office in IBM or Shell or Barclays Bank or whatever it may be God's calling to you, Christian though you are. No compromises involved in that, provided you are careful to live up to the moral standards of the Bible in a secular world, as Daniel did. You may find that, like him, you are given opportunities for Christian testimony in public affairs, which no pastor or missionary could ever have. However, the story does contain a cautionary note, nevertheless, for those who feel God is calling them in that direction. If you are called to serve God in such a secular environment, you must be ready to encounter hostility. Daniel did. Look at verse 4. At this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, "We will never find any basis for charges against this man Daniel unless it has something to do with the law of his God." There's nothing new, you see, about dirty tricks campaigns being perpetrated in government offices. They have been going on for time immemorial. Daniel's colleagues had it in for him and were determined to find some way to discredit him. Partly, no doubt, their animosity was motivated by professional jealousy. Daniel was better at his job than they were, and was clearly in line to be promoted over their heads. Partly, too, it may have been there may have been an element of racist prejudice. Though Daniel's Semitic origins wouldn't have mattered in the least to Darius, because he was a foreigner himself, to the indigenous remnant of Nebuchadnezzar's administration in Babylon, the royal privilege which these Jews had been enjoying had been a running sore for many years, going right back to the days of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Some suggest, thirdly, that their actions may have been an attempt to preempt a crackdown on corruption in the civil service, which they anticipated Daniel would want to instigate once he was installed as governor. Everybody knew what a penchant he had for clearing out corruption. The last thing they wanted to do was to come under his official invigilation. Paul Mills of our fellowship here tells me there is in Britain now an organisation called Whistleblowers Anonymous, which aims to bring together people who feel they've been discriminated against as a result of their determination to expose corruption in high places in this country. Well, it could well be that these satraps were seeking to make Daniel the patron saint of that organisation here. And on top of all these possible motives for their political chicanery, I think we mustn't underestimate either an irrational, dare I say demonic, element in the conspiracy. For Daniel was not just a good man. He was God's man. I think it's quite clear that his presence and his prayers were a key element in God's plan to restore his people to the promised land. He was therefore an obstacle to any satanic attempt to turn the Medo-Persian Empire against the Jews and thwart that declared purpose of God. Behind the envy and the vindictiveness and the Machiavellian cunning of his colleagues in office then, surely Daniel was also experiencing the subtle manoeuvrings of what the Apostle Paul calls principalities and powers in the spiritual realms. Anyway, they try, first of all, you notice, the sordid tactics of Sunday newspaper journalism. They spy on his every move to see what muck they can rake up against Daniel. But they're thwarted, for Daniel has no skeletons hiding in his cupboards. He's clean. Too clean to impeach, and too clever to trap. The only way we're going to get rid of him is by engineering some situation in which, ironically, the very earnestness of his own high principles will be the death of him, they said. So that's what they did. The administrators and the satraps went as a group to the king and said, "O King Darius, live forever. The royal administrators have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or man during the next 30 days, except to you, O king, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Now, O king, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered in accordance with the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be annulled." So King Darius put the decree in writing. Poor old Darius, you can't help feeling a bit sorry for him. Manipulated here by their sycophantic flattery, he just didn't recognize the frame-up in which he was now an unwitting accomplice. It all sounded so plausible, didn't it? "It's politically prudent," they all said. "It'll be good for the empire. It'll make clear to everybody the allegiance we all feel to you, O king. It's not tyrannical in any way. We're all agreed. It's a very democratic move, we assure you. Everybody wants it." "Oh, of course. It involves a minor infringement of a few personal liberties, but no reasonable person will object. After all, it's only a short-term measure, 30 days. And it doesn't require anybody to actually do anything, does it? I mean, it's a prohibition, that's all, like banning smoking on the tube or beer at football matches." In a sense, of course, they were right to minimize the importance of it by comparison with many of the insane and oppressive edicts prescribed by other ancient kings in celebration of their royal divinity. This was a most modest and innocuous measure. Well, that's the point, you see. Even modest and innocuous measures can become instruments of cruel tyranny where the jurisprudence of positive law hold sway. and in the empire of the Medes and Persians, it most certainly did. Issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered in accordance with the laws of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be annulled, they said. Many commentators suggest that the irrevocability of Persian law is being mocked in this story. That's why the narrator keeps chorusing this catchphrase about it being impossible to annul it. He says it in verse 8, he says it in verse 12, he says it in verse 15. It's another example of his satirizing. And undoubtedly there is truth in that. The whole point of this story is that at the end of the day, the immutable law of Persia gets muted, changed. But it would be a mistake to caricature this aspect of Persian legislation as if it were some pompous eccentricity. That isn't so at all. There is no doubt that Persia was an enlightened empire. And I'm sure Cyrus had good reason for establishing such a framework of immutable statutory legislation in it. But if you think about it, you see, this was the largest empire the world had ever known, wielded out of a host of older nations and empires, each with their own independent traditions. In such a pluralistic atmosphere, it was vital to create respect for imperial law and order. And one obvious way of doing that was to make sure everybody realized that throughout the empire there was one law for everybody and no exceptions to the rules. I have no doubt at all that this distinctive principle of jurisprudence, that any law written down and signed by the king was to be enforced without fear or favor, was regarded as a fine testimony to the superiority of the Persian legal system. There was a scientific rigor to it that would have appealed to those scientific Persians. And indeed, to John Austin, come to that, who we were quoting earlier. For nobody was ever in doubt what the law of the Medes and Persians were. It could never be evaded by a whim of the judge or even by the emperor himself. It was the acme of positive law. Law was what the government decreed. People were entitled to have their various moral opinions if they wished, and the state would tolerate them, provided they realized that such speculations had nothing to do with what was legal. The clear and unambiguous statutes of the government came first. The vague and imprecise arguments of conscience that prevailed in that pluralistic atmosphere had to come second. It was the only way to run the country. Like the law of gravity, you see. The law of the Medes and Persians was predictable, absolutely certain. But unfortunately, for a man of God like Daniel, such a view of law was absolutely unacceptable. That's why he broke it. Let's come to the second part of the story then, in verse 10. Now, when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened toward Jerusalem. Three times a day he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. This model of private devotion to God, which Daniel provides for us here, though in a way you could say it's incidental to the plot, would again have been of enormous relevance to those Jews in exile when they first read this story. For, as we just said earlier, the great challenge facing them was, how do you retain your holiness as the people of God when all the outward trappings of religious privilege have been taken away from you and you're surrounded by pagan idolatry? They had no temple, they had no priesthood, they had no liturgy. The corporate worship, which had been at the very heart of Judaism, was impossible for them really now. Would they not therefore inevitably be absorbed into Babylonian culture? How could they survive spiritually on their own? Dispersed in this way. Well, Daniel points to the answer. An answer which I'm sure the narrator of Daniel wants to get across to his own audience. Even if there's no temple, no synagogue, even if you're the only one, you can still maintain a relationship with God as a member of the people of God. Through your own private devotional life. Like Daniel did. The people of God don't need a temple, they don't need a priesthood, they don't need a liturgy. No matter how isolated he or she may be, through prayer, every individual believer has personal access to God. That must have been immensely encouraging, don't you think, for those Jews? Immensely important lesson for them to learn, and of course it has immense relevance also to us as Christians. For we too must often survive in an isolated environment surrounded by secularism or even paganism. Prayer is the vital instrument by which we sustain our relationship with God in those circumstances too. So maybe it's worthwhile just noticing some features of Daniel's praying. Notice first the regularity of it. It's quite clear, isn't it, that this was no last desperate resort. This was a daily discipline. Unlike Islam, there was no law in Judaism specifying how often prayer should take place, but clearly Daniel had devised this 3-times-a-day pattern for himself. I suspect we need to do the same, you know, to work out how to schedule prayer into our regular routines. It isn't always easy, and 3 times a day may well be nigh on impossible for some of us. But we have to work it out, how we structure prayer into our regular routine. Notice, too, the posture of Daniel's praying. He got down on his knees. Once again, there's no rule in the Bible about this. But that doesn't mean that posture is irrelevant. I look at it this way, you know, Daniel was a very important man. Most of the time, hosts of juniors got down on their knees to him. So clearly he felt it was important when he approached God that he abandoned quite consciously and deliberately any trace of pride which that sycophantic adulation of his Persian inferiors may have subtly infiltrated into his attitude. It was important for him to recognize the majesty of the God he was addressing and his own personal unworthiness to speak. And whilst I make no rule about posture in prayer, I will say this to you. The richer you are, the cleverer you are, the more powerful you are, in worldly terms, the more relevant is Daniel's example to you. And the more uncongenial getting on your knees will feel. That's the third thing, too, to notice about Daniel's praying. Do you notice the direction of it? We're told the window opened towards Jerusalem, and he quite deliberately found a room to pray where he could open the window and look out for Jerusalem in that way. Now, this is significant because if you turn over a couple of pages to Daniel 9, you'll find that Daniel there himself gives us an example of the kind of prayer which he was offering at this time of his life in the first year of Darius the king. And it was a prayer all about Jerusalem. We know that at this time, Daniel was praying prayers of confession on behalf of the people of Israel, recognizing that they were being duly punished in exile according to the covenant law of Moses because of all their moral and spiritual apostasy. But praying also a prayer of petition, pleading the promise of God through the prophet Jeremiah that the exile would be of limited duration, and begging God that with this change in political climate at Babylon, in the providential mercy of God, the speedy restoration of the Jews to their homeland might result. Quite certainly, then, this was no self-indulgent meditation that Daniel was engaging in 3 times a day. This was the hard work of intercessory prayer. As a prophet, he had a crucial intercessory role to fulfill on behalf of the people of God. And no satanically inspired conspiracy was going to stop him praying. It was that important. And that brings us to the fourth thing to note about it. The resolution of his prayer. When he learned the decree had been published, he nevertheless went home, and 3 times a day he got down on his knees and prayed, just as he had done before. I have absolutely no doubt in my mind that a fellow as sharp as Daniel was knew what his rivals were up to. As soon as he heard of the king's decree, he must have smelt a rat, guessed that he was being set up. And yet we read he quite deliberately refuses to be intimidated. It would have been very easy, would it not, to have just stopped praying for the 30-day period. After all, there was no sin involved. He'd chosen this prayer routine. Well, he could unchoose it if he wanted to. There was no verse in the Bible that said thou should have a quiet time 3 times a day. At the very least, he could have changed the venue. He didn't have to do it in the same place all the time. But no, you see, that would have been a sellout. He wasn't prepared for that. Prayer for him was the bottom line. No government could make prayer illegal. It was ultra vires, unconstitutional, even if there was no constitution. Any government that tried to do so had to be disobeyed. Not that his civil disobedience was particularly loud, you notice. The observation that the windows opened toward Jerusalem probably implies that Daniel could be seen praying from the street below if he were nosy enough to look. But it would be quite wrong to conclude, as some have done, that there was anything ostentatious about Daniel's prayer times. On the contrary, it seems quite clear that his policy was to pray inconspicuously at home. And he didn't change that. He didn't seek to be deliberately provocative or defiant. He just went on quietly and courageously doing what he'd always done. Because once again, in so doing, he set a great example to those Jews in exile, didn't he? And to us. Of what it means to be a witness in a secular or pagan environment. By comparison, so much of our so-called Christian testimony is revealed to be cowardice, isn't it? Many of us shirk even the nailing of our colours to the mast in the school dormitory or the college refectory. Be seen praying? You've got to be joking, that's far too embarrassing. Indeed, there are some of us who, like frightened rabbits, spend a good deal of our time hunting for Christian burrows in which to hide ourselves for spiritual safety in this big, bad, nasty, secular, pagan world. At lectures we sit with our Christian friends. At lunch we sit with our Christian friends. In the evening we go to our Christian Bible studies. Our whole life is carefully structured to be as invisible as possible to the non-Christian world. Open a window, don't even open the keyhole. And so Daniel, he knew his rivals had been spying on him with hostile intent, but he didn't try to stop them or to foil their little plot. He just went on doing what he'd always done, putting God first through a regular time of prayer. And he waited for them to take the opportunity to spring their trap. For I guess he must have thought that King Darius, like Belshazzar and Nebuchadnezzar before him, needed to learn a lesson. The same lesson that we have learned again and again and again in our series of studies. Our God reigns. There is a sovereign God in heaven who overrules the actions of men, who takes precedence over every human government, and who cannot be thwarted even by the unchangeable laws of the Medes and the Persians. And that brings us to the final movement of the story. The law which God overruled. Verse 11. Then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. So they went to the king and spoke to him about his royal decree. Didn't you publish a decree that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or man except to you, O king, would be thrown into the lion's den? The king answered, the decree stands in accordance with the laws of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be annulled. Then they said to the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the decree you put in writing. He still prays 3 times a day. When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel and made every effort until sundown to save him. So the narrator shows us that it wasn't just Daniel who had been trapped. The king, too, now realizes that he is the victim of the inflexibility of his own judicial system. Desperately, he consults with his legal advisors to find some loophole, but no! The empire is committed to the ideological doctrine of positive law. No matter how unfair it is, king, no matter how contrary to natural justice, there's nothing you can do about it. The rule of law must prevail. If you spare Daniel, the credibility of the entire Persian law and order system will be thrown into doubt. You can't afford to lose face like that. You can't take that risk. Once people think they can disobey your commands, to put their own moral values or religious priorities ahead of the law of the state? Well, we should have a wholesale anarchy. People must know that if they disobey the law, they will pay the price. I suppose if the civil service had been on Darius' side in this matter, he could have succeeded in hushing the whole affair up. We know such things happen. But unfortunately, the civil service was not on Darius' side. It was quite obvious to him that the civil service itself had engineered this frame-up. It was a dirty drink campaign, all right? And there was no way the civil service were going to let him, the emperor, off the hook. They even go to him again in verse 15. Remember, O king, that according to the law of the Medes and Persians, no decree or edict the king issues can be changed. Don't think you're going to wiggle out of this, Darius. We've got you over a barrel. So after an entire day of frantic legal consultation, Darius realizes he has been maneuvered into a political corner with no way out. Verse 16, so the king gave the order. And they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, may your God whom you serve continually rescue you. A stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den. And the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the rings of his nobles, so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. And then the king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating, without entertainment. He couldn't sleep. The hunting of the Asian lion was a royal sport in the Persian Empire, so there was nothing strange that Darius had his own private supply of these beasts. It says much, doesn't it, for the humanity of the man that he suffered such pangs of anxiety and guilt all through this night, unable to sleep, unable to eat, unable to watch TV. I can just imagine him, can't you, cursing under his breath for being him, cursing himself for being so stupid. How could I be taken for a ride like that? To allow them to talk me into playing God for a month. Why, it's infantile, I should be beyond that. I should have recognized it for the ploy it was. Now it's too late. The best man in my cabinet is on death row. Unless this God Daniel worships really is something special, of course. So in verse 19 we read, at the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. When he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice. Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions? Daniel answered, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me, because I was found innocent in his sight, nor have I ever done any wrong before you. Okay. Now, it's not hard, is it, to imagine the tonic to the morale which this climax to the adventure would have been for those Jews in exile that the author of Daniel is writing for. Of course, the Bible never promises that when the people of God stand up faithfully for him at the risk of their lives, they're always going to be delivered. The ending is always going to be a happy one. It's no accident that the Greek word for witness is martyr. That's often the way it goes. In that reading we had from Hebrews 11 a little earlier, there were plenty of examples, weren't there, of folk who were not rescued as Daniel was, but who were nevertheless commended for their faith. Even so, this miraculous deliverance is intended for our encouragement. The law of the Medes and Persians was not as unchangeable as they made out. For our God reigns. There is a sovereign who has authority over the penal sanctions of Persia. God can turn their hungry lions into docile pets. There is a sovereign who has authority over the Machiavellian cunning of Persian civil servants, who's even able to turn the immutable statute of a King Darius back upon the heads of those who so corruptly extracted it. So we read in verse 24, at the king's command, the men who had falsely accused Daniel were brought in and thrown into the lion's den along with their wives and their children. And before they'd reached the floor of the den, the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Cruel, undoubtedly. But it does prove the lions were hungry. And of course, in the ancient world, such poetic justice was considered a necessary deterrent against malicious accusation and false testimony. Then, in one final irony, notice Darius issues another, presumably immutable, written edict. But this time, not forbidding prayer, but commanding it. Why hadn't he thought of that in the first place? You can't repeal an immutable law, then pass another one that contradicts it, and then let the jurists of positive law sort the mess out. Then King Darius wrote to all peoples, nations, and men of every language throughout the land, "May you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions." Now, as we've said, this story lends application in all sorts of ways. And we have noticed, as we've read the story, some of the applications that would have struck those original readers of it and which are still relevant to us today. There's a lesson about social involvement, the validity of our secular calling as men and women of God. There's a lesson about the importance of our devotional lives, particularly when we have to survive without the support of corporate worship. We've also learned the reassuring truth that God is sovereign over all the affairs of men, and the hairs of our head are numbered, and no ultimate harm can come to a believer, even if he's called to be faithful unto death, as Daniel was. All these lessons are of great value. They would have been lessons of value to the Jews in exile. They're of value to us today. But supremely this morning, I want to impress upon you the lesson which I think is rather unique to this particular passage of Scripture. A lesson about the importance of standing against the godless arrogance of positive law. I say again, the ultimate reason for miscarriages of justice in this world is not that governments enact bad laws or that courts enforce bad laws, but because both governments and courts, in their proud autonomy, think they have the right to make laws in the first place. We don't. True law is never made but found. Its cogency rests not on the arbitrary dictates of a human legislature or judiciary, but upon the eternal and unchanging moral character of God. Now, in centuries past, jurists in the West understood this. Blackstone, one of the founding writers of the British Constitution in the 17th century, insisted, "The Ten Commandments were the foundation plank of the common law of England," he said. No government legislation could contradict the Ten Commandments. In the United States, too, there has been a steady stream ever since the days of the Declaration of Independence, insisting that there is a higher law. One thinks of the famous words of William Seward when he was resisting the slave laws of the 19th century. "There is a higher law than the American Constitution," he insisted. Throughout English and American history, the issue of liberty has often turned on the existence of this conviction that there is a higher law than the law of the state. Call it natural justice, call it equity, call it conscience, call it what you like. For the Christian, it is the law of God. He is the absolute. All human, man-made laws are relatives in comparison to him and gain their authority only as they reflect his concerns. And I want to suggest to you that there can be no secure, free society where those claims are not acknowledged. In the 1930s, you know, the place in Europe where positive law was most popular among jurists was unquestionably Germany. It appealed to the Germanic mentality, I guess. They were the most extreme advocates of positive law. And many of them, like, for instance, the famous jurist Radbruch, learned to their cost the moral blindness to which such an emphasis can lead a people. For the Nazis quite deliberately exploited this German attitude of subservience to constitutional law. Ironically, as in Daniel's case, it was once again the Jews who were the target of their malicious abuse of the legal system. These days, in Europe, we have a Bill of Rights. The European Court in Strasbourg is constituted in order to enforce that Bill of Rights. And part of that comes out of the experience of Hitler's Germany. The conviction of the Nuremberg trials that the statutes of Hitler were contrary to justice and should not have been obeyed. Would that we had a Bill of Rights in this country of our own. It would be a help. But not a guarantee. For as our American friends will tell us, in the United States, interestingly, it isn't the legislature which is creating the structure of positive law, but the judiciary, particularly the Supreme Court, in its review of the Constitution and its creation of laws as unconstitutional or constitutional based on its understanding of the Constitution. Now, no matter, you see, which side of the Atlantic you look, the attitude is growing that men have the power to make laws as they please, whether in accordance with their own ideological goals as governments, or in accordance with sociological trends, as judiciaries. And bills of rights, independence of the courts, and so on, are no guarantee that that will not lead to further tyranny. Positive law is always a recipe for disaster. Freedom can only be sustained in this or any other country, so long as the legislature, the judiciary, and the people themselves acknowledge the existence of the higher law, God's law. You cannot have a free society without a moral consensus. It's as simple as that. But in the absence of a moral consensus, law must come in with its cramping, burdensome leviathan of over-regulation. It must come in to define order. As no doubt Darius felt law had to come into his Medo-Persian Empire to define order. And just like pre-war Germany, such a society is wide open, either to tyranny or anarchy. Christians of all people should know how dangerous it is to obey the state too well. Christians of all people should know how easily Satan himself insinuates himself onto the side of law and order. For we honour this morning the Lord, one who, like Daniel, was himself the victim of an establishment plot. One who, just like Daniel, because his face was set towards Jerusalem, found himself hounded to the scaffold in the name of justice. We have a law, that's what they said. We have a law, and by that law he ought to die. Can you believe it? Well, they had a law, all right, but it wasn't the law of God, was it? And Pilate should have known it. But poor Pilate, just like Darius, was too weak, too enmeshed in the construction of his own legal system to overrule the injustice of it all. Jesus himself pointed it out to him. You could have no power at all over me, he said, unless it were given you from above. But such appeals, such arguments from the higher law were lost on a pilot. So Jesus died. One more victim of judicial murder. An innocent man. The most innocent man who has ever lived. Like Daniel, you know, he didn't organize an armed revolution. He didn't stage a public protest. He didn't even speak much in his own defense. Like Daniel, he just prayed and let them feed him to the lions. They put a stone over his tomb too, didn't they? And sealed it to make sure it was all legal and above board. But like Daniel, the higher law could not be set aside in that contemptuous fashion. Our God reigns. He broke the chains of death itself to affirm the unchallengeable superiority of his sovereign claims over the universe. authority in heaven and earth is given to me, he said. From that empty cross, there have come a stream of faithful men who, believing that all authority in heaven and earth belongs to Christ, have, like Daniel, had the courage to witness against the abuse of legislative authority in their nations. From Peter to Luther to Martin Luther King, if you like. We must obey God rather than men, they said. Jesus is Lord. Well, it's quite simple. I'm inviting you this morning to join their company. The company of those noble saints who we're singing about, who down through the centuries have witnessed a good confession. I'm inviting you to join their company. See, we Christians are not rebels. On the contrary, like Daniel, we want to serve the society of which we're a part with integrity and faithfulness, and if God gives us opportunity to rise into high office in it, we will. But we will not bow to the tyranny of godless law. On the contrary, every day we shall pray. And by that prayer we affirm to the Darius of this world that we own allegiance to a prior king, a greater king. His kingdom will last forever. So why don't you join us? I'm not promising you that it will be a prosperous ride, necessarily. On the contrary, you must expect hostility, even as Daniel found it. There is an enemy, and the New Testament says, like a roaring lion, he's seeking Daniel's to devour. But I tell you this. Follow this Lord Christ. Make him your king. And you will be your own person. You'll be a real human being, knowing freedom and dignity. In a world where increasingly it seems the only alternative is to be a slave of the system. I tell you, frankly, I find that a most liberating and fulfilling thing. You say, how do I begin? You begin where Daniel began. By praying. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Let's pray together.